Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
How can you describe this as a dictatorial, repressive government when Guaido, who proclaimed himself a president when he wasn't, has called for the army to remove the government, the democratically elected president, has called for military intervention by a foreign power, and then on Tuesday, he carried out a coup against an attempted coup with military force. He's still free.
That's the voice of Jorge Martí. In this week's show, we continue our discussion with Jorge Martí, Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. We talk about this week's latest coup attempt and the future of Venezuela and workers around the world. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm privileged this morning to be joined by Jorge Martí. He is the Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. Welcome to our show, Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. Now, this past week has been a momentous week for the people of Venezuela. Can you paint a picture of what the situation is like in Venezuela at this moment?
Yes, what happened on Tuesday, the 30th of April, was that Guaido, the opposition leader, attempted a military coup. He issued a video early in the morning, just before 6 in the morning, with some where he was flanked by some soldiers, about maybe 20, 30, 40 soldiers. And he was also accompanied by Leopoldo López, who is a Venezuelan opposition leader who was arrested after the 2014 Guarimba rioting by the opposition. And he was charged with destruction of property, incitement to violence, and so on. And he was under house arrest. So apparently he was released by the troops that were guarding him in his house. And some of these troops joined Guaido. And in this video, early in the morning video on Tuesday, April the 30th, he made an appeal. Well, he basically said that all military units in the country were with him and that they were going to remove the Maduro and, in his words, restore constitutional order. But very soon it appeared, it became clear that this coup was going nowhere and half of the things he had said were not true. First of all, he was not inside the La Carlota military airbase, as he had claimed. He was outside of the base. He did not have any command of troops. And by mid-morning, it became clear that all of the military officers and all of the military bases in the country were still loyal to the democratically elected President Maduro. And by the end of the day, his attempted coup had completely collapsed. Some of the soldiers that were with him said that they'd been taken there under false pretenses, and they returned to their military bases and left, abandoned the coup. Some others sought asylum in the Brazilian embassy, and Leopoldo López, his main co-conspirator, went into hiding into the Chilean embassy first and then the Spanish embassy. So basically what we saw on Tuesday was a very badly prepared and carried out coup, but also a very dangerous one, because it could have very easily led to armed clashes in the capital, which did not happen. And basically, obviously, the United States gave full support to the coup as the coup was developing. Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and others said that this was the restoration of democracy, that they fully supported this. There was also during the day, there was a big Chavista demonstration outside the Miraflores Palace. President Maduro had called on the people to come and defend the Miraflores Palace. There were thousands of people there. By the end of the day, the coup had collapsed. But the day after, which was May Day yesterday, there were also opposition demonstrations in different parts of the country. There was also a Chavista demonstration. And Guaido was still free. And he participated and addressed the opposition demonstration in Caracas. So that's basically what's happened this week, which is obviously part of what's been happening since January, when Guaido proclaimed himself to be the president with the full backing of the United States and other right-wing governments. And this is basically all part of this attempt by the Trump administration to implement regime change in Venezuela and remove the President Maduro.
It would be comical if it wasn't so violent and dangerous. This is not the first time that the U.S. has tried a coup against the Bolivarian people. This time, I think the aggression has been more systematic and more devastating in terms of the economic and trade tools that are being used to squeeze and debilitate the people of Venezuela. Can we talk a little bit about the amping of the sanctions that happened on March 29th?
Yes. I mean, the sanctions on Venezuela on the part of the United States were originally introduced under the Obama administration in 2015 when he signed an executive order that declared that the situation in Venezuela was an immediate and present threat to the U.S. national security. And on the basis of that executive order, a number of sanctions have been implemented over the last 4 years. The first sanctions were so-called targeted sanctions that affected government officials and officials in the government, in the army, and so on. But then, as of August 2017, the sanctions were stepped up, and the sanctions were now preventing anyone from trading with Venezuelan bonds and debt and state debt, issuing new bonds or state debt. So basically they were trying to cut off the Venezuelan government from access to the financial markets. And then finally, as you say, in January, February this year, then there was a massive stepping up of the sanctions, whereby the U.S. government declared a complete embargo on any oil purchases from Venezuela. We have to remember that the United States was one of the main purchasers of Venezuelan oil to the tune of between 500,000 and 700,000 barrels of oil per day. So this really hit the Venezuelan economy very badly. And also these sanctions prevent Venezuela from purchasing anything in the United States, including the fact that Venezuela has to, Venezuelan oil, particularly in the Orinoco Belt, is extra heavy crude oil that needs to be refined. And in order to be refined, they need a number of products, including dissolvents, naphtha, and which Venezuela used to purchase 90% from the United States. So this is now also cut off. On top of this, the U.S. also seized assets belonging to the Venezuelan oil company in the United States worth $7 billion U.S. dollars. And to all intents and purposes, they have seized all assets by Citgo, which is a subsidiary of PDVSA in the United States, which is also very damaging. And not only this, but throughout this period, the United States has also been threatening third parties like India, Russia, number of commercial banks that were trading with Venezuela in other countries, Turkey. They've been threatening them to respect U.S. sanctions or else be faced with sanctions themselves. So basically, they're attempting to strangulate, to asphyxiate the Venezuelan economy, which is heavily dependent on oil, in the hope that this will convince either the population to rise up against Maduro or the army to move to remove him from power, something that, which hasn't happened so far. This attempted coup has been unsuccessful, and I stress that it has been unsuccessful so far. It doesn't mean that the danger is over. It doesn't mean that the United States is going to let go or ease off of the regime change attempts.
Can you talk a little bit about what this has what the impact of this has been on the population of Venezuela in terms of health, in terms of the lives that are being caused by the sanctions?
The economic crisis in Venezuela is very serious. It has knocked out about 50% of GDP since 2014. And the cause of the Venezuelan economic crisis is not sanctions, but quite clearly sanctions heavily aggravate the economic crisis and its impact on the population. For instance, if Venezuela is unable to renegotiate its debt, it means that it has to pay its debt in full or else default on its debt payments, which will further isolate it from the financial market. This means using the scarce amount of money it has in foreign currency reserves to pay the debt, instead of using this money to purchase much needed food and medical supplies, with a direct impact on the country's on the population's well-being. On top of this, if Venezuela is unable to sell oil to the United States, it then has to look for other customers, which is a complex and costly and time-consuming process, which is not solved in one day. If Venezuela cannot purchase dissolvents from the United States, then it has to look for those from other countries which are much farther away, like Nigeria or others, at a bigger cost, at a higher cost. So all of this has a direct impact on the ability of the government to continue carrying out the social programs it carried out in the past, and it has led to a situation where obviously there's more scarcity of basic products, there's more scarcity of medications, and so on. There's a new study by the CEPR in the United States, which calculates that about 40,000 people have died in Venezuela in the last few years, directly or indirectly as a result of the sanctions regime. So that's the real cost of these sanctions, which are designed to cause pain on the population. That's quite clear.
When we think about what we want in society, we see throughout the world voices rising against a very consolidated wealth class that continues the plundering and colonization of many places. In the case of, we focus on Venezuela, and you know, the media points at Venezuela as a place where there's injustice. But we forget soon that, you know, very much here in Canada, indigenous people are still without potable water. We have 280 communities without potable water, where injustice is the order of the day. We see in Europe, you know, the case of the Yellow Jackets. And what this says to me is the resonance of creating a culture where insecurity and instability of the working class of people and the average people is the order of the day. And I think that's perhaps why Venezuela poses such a threat to the world, is that Venezuelans were able not only to pay off their debt, but were also able to create social services and social, you know, safety networks that help people thrive. Can we talk a little bit about what is at risk if we allow this plundering, this very odious ways of systematic, you know, economic isolation of a country like Venezuela to continue?
Yeah, it's clear. It's quite clear that the Bolivarian Revolution at its peak managed to deliver social programs that greatly benefited the lives of millions of people in very concrete terms. For instance, Venezuela introduced free higher education for all, increasing the number of university students from 800,000 to 2.3 million, massively increased the number of people receiving old age pensions, improved the access to health care to the majority of the country's poor in a program run together with Cuban medical doctors and medical personnel. They also managed a program of house building, which has built and delivered 2 million units of social housing free of charge for those receiving them. And so Venezuela, which is a third world country, has managed to implement policies by using the resources of the country for the benefit of the majority, has managed to implement programs which put many advanced capitalist countries to shame. I mean, I'm based here in London in the UK, and over here we have a completely disastrous situation where university students have to pay tuition fees, which leave them massively in debt when they finish their studies, where NHS, the National Health Service, is being starved of funds. Today, they just published a figure that 200 nurses have committed suicide over the last 4 years because of overwork and stress caused by cuts in healthcare and education. Millions of people have to use food banks because they can't make ends meet on a monthly basis. So Venezuela became, the Bolivarian Revolution became a very dangerous example for the capitalist world of what was possible. If Guaido comes to power, there is no doubt that all of this will be eradicated. I mean, some of the conquests of the Bolivarian Revolution have already been eroded by the economic crisis, by the sanctions regime, and so on. But some still remain. And all of this will be eliminated, will be destroyed completely if Guaido comes to power, backed by Trump. He has already published his program. It's called the Plan País, the program for the country. And it involves the privatization of all state-owned companies, the return of the land, which was distributed to the peasants, to the former landowners, which left it idle in the past, the massive program of layoffs in the public sector under the slogan of rationalization, the introduction of privatization in healthcare, in education, the opening up of the oil industry to foreign multinationals in very favorable terms, which is something that John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, demanded a couple of months ago. It's a destruction of workers' rights. It's a program really of an all-out assault against all the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. This will be a defeat not only for the Venezuelan working people, the workers, the poor, the peasants, but also for working people around the world. They want to make Venezuela an example that if you try to go against the policies that the United States is imposing everywhere, the policies of capitalist austerity and cuts, the opening up of to private investment, the privatization of everything that moves, then you will pay a heavy price for that. This is the reason why we need to defend the Bolivarian Revolution. I would say we need to defend and expand the Bolivarian Revolution.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what inspires you, because in spite of all the aggression against Venezuela, in spite of all the aggression, both economic, the military threat, the way that is being surrounded, the people continue to be strong. And in spite of all the blackouts and everything that has been thrown at them, the Venezuelan people seem to be standing strong. And I wonder if you could talk about why that is, what keeps them inspired, what can we learn from there?
Yes, I think that in Venezuela, obviously, the support for the Bolivarian Revolution and the Maduro government has steadily been going down, particularly since 2014 with the economic crisis. There are many people who are disillusioned with the government, with the inability of the government to deal with the economic crisis. There are many people who are critical of the bureaucratic way in which popular initiative is being stifled by government officials and so on. But when it comes to this coup, which started in January, on January 24th, when Guaido proclaimed himself the president of Venezuela at a street rally, there are many people, even people who are critical of the government, that they are very clear that what they don't want is an imperialist intervention in the country, that they don't want Guaido to come to power, because that will be a massive disaster for everyone, for all working people. I myself am critical of some of the policies of the Maduro government, which I think has been too compromising with the opposition. It has made too many concessions to the capitalist class, which have not served for any useful purpose, and that instead of trying to make compromises or going forward on some of the legacy of Hugo Chavez, the government should be going forward, not backwards. But nevertheless, when it comes to an imperialist intervention like this is very clearly, when it comes to an attempted coup, regime change, which is backed by imperialism, there is a very strong anti-imperialist feeling amongst the layers of the workers, the poor, and the peasants. And they have been really in the last four months, while this coup has been going on, this attempted coup, there have been mass demonstrations in Caracas, in other parts of the country, in Bolivar, in Merida, everywhere. And these have generally not been reported in the mass media outside of Venezuela because it doesn't fit their narrative. They tell you that the government has no support amongst the population, is only in power because of its repressive ways. But I'm asking myself, how can you describe this as a dictatorial repressive government when Guaido, who proclaimed himself a president when he wasn't, has called for the army to remove the government, the democratically elected president, has called for military intervention by a foreign power. And then on Tuesday, he carried out a coup against an attempted coup with military force. He's still free. Yesterday, he was addressing a May Day rally. Yesterday, Wednesday, he was addressing a May Day rally in Caracas. So how can you describe this? If anything, you can criticize Maduro for having been too lenient, for not being strong enough against the opposition, which is a coup-plotting, undemocratic opposition. And it's a credit to the Venezuelan people, the fact that they've resisted all of this, and they're still very much loyal to the Bolivarian Revolution in large numbers, perhaps not as large as they were under Chavez, but still a large section of the population wants to defend the legacy of President Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution because they have benefited from it, because the Bolivarian Revolution has given them a voice, has given them power, has given them a degree of decision over their own lives and their own future. And I'll just give you one example. On Tuesday, during the attempted coup, some opposition thugs in Caricuao, which is a working class area in Caracas, they ransacked and assaulted and set on fire a building which belonged to a local socialist commune. And in this building, there was a textile cooperative run by working women from the neighborhood themselves. They had a few sewing machines, and they were producing T-shirts and other things like this. They basically pooled their resources together to have a source of income. And with great effort, they managed to acquire these machines, and they were working in this building, which was also a community center. So these opposition thugs, they went in there, they stole the sewing machines, they destroyed the building, they set it on fire. And this is the reason, in this very little incident, you can see the reason why working people and the poor in Venezuela hate the opposition. The opposition is drawn mainly from the middle class and the upper class layers of society, is led by bourgeois elements in cahoots with imperialism and people, quite rightly, with a very fine class instinct. They hate them. They hate them. And however many criticisms they might have of the government or the government's lack of action or the government's policies, they definitely do not want the oligarchy to come back to power, because they know very well what that would mean in Venezuela.
Most of Latin Americans who have lived through the 80s, who have lived through or experienced their parents' stories of invasions in Latin America, do not want coup-imposed governments. And so as we face this so-called league of, led by Canada, of the Lima Group, as we face the aggression of U.S. sanctions, as we face this systematic attacks, how do we stand strong and in solidarity with the people in Venezuela? Because part of me says, well, you fight where you are, because, whether it's, standing with the yellow jackets if you're in France, or standing with indigenous people if you're in Canada, or standing with the poor and displaced in the U.S. who are homeless and hungry. I think that unites us in our movements, and this is how we gain strength. But how do you see us moving towards a society where plundering and pillaging is a story of the past?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to comment that the Group of Lima is an ad hoc group of countries which has no legal standing whatsoever. This group of countries was only set up because the United States was unable to carry out its resolutions against Venezuela on the Organization of American States. And so then they set up a group which is only united. It's a group of countries that they are only united by one thing: the hatred of the Bolivarian Revolution. And it includes, obviously, Canada, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and others. But more generally, you are right. Even President Chavez at one point said the best way to help the Venezuelan Revolution is to carry out the revolution in your own countries. And I think that this is very true. There is a worldwide mood of sympathy for socialism. People realize that capitalism is unable to provide for the majority, is unable to provide housing, education, healthcare, decent wages, basic human requirements, not only in third world countries, but also in advanced capitalist countries like in Britain, in Canada, in the US. And particularly amongst young people, there is a growing support for socialism. Even though the idea of what socialism is might not be completely clear, but it's clear that they don't want capitalism and they want a system that is able to guarantee housing, decent and free education, health care for all, and also a future for our planet, which is threatened by capitalist profits, which are destroying the environment. And this can only be achieved if there is a fundamental change in the way we run our economy. Capitalism, the private profit running everything, cannot provide for any of these things, even though in some countries in the past it was partially able to do so. But the future is socialism, really, a system where the economic means, the means of production, are collectively owned and democratically planned by the majority of the population to satisfy the needs of the many. And how do we get from capitalism to socialism? It's through a revolution. And a revolution means organizing to fight for immediate and local things, for better wages in your factory, for free healthcare, for free education, big and small struggles, everyday struggles, and more momentous movements. Until such a point, we are strong enough to take over the whole economy and overthrow this rotten capitalist regime, which threatens to put an end to life in the planet itself.
Thank you so much for being with us today. The last words are yours.
Yes, I will say that the defense of the Bolivarian Revolution is an extremely important task today. This is now the country that is more directly under threat of U.S. imperialism with the support of other imperialist countries like Canada and the United Kingdom over here. And therefore, a victory for us here on this question is a victory for us all. And a defeat for our class in Venezuela will be a defeat for us all as well. So therefore, we need to organize, we need to spread truthful information about what's happening in Venezuela. We need to cut through the fog of lies in the mass media. But that struggle, the struggle to defend the Bolivarian Revolution, is part of the more general struggle for the socialist transformation of society. So I will advise everyone to heed the old slogan of the industrial workers of the world, the anarcho-syndicalist union from 100 years ago. They had a beautiful slogan, which was agitate, educate, and organize. So we need to be involved, we need to inform ourselves, and we need to be part of an organized movement to transform society.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That was Jorge Marti. We reached him in England. Thank you for listening.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.